related to the LGBTQ+ community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, Box of Sin. That next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gordep of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada. And Rainbow Country is also a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. And all of that is thanks to you choosing to tune in, to stream, download, but ultimately choosing to listen. So today, a flashback to my 2023 interview with British DJ and music consultant Mark Wood, who talks about putting together the compilation Box of Sin, a box set that takes the listener on a musical journey through the gay club scene from 1980 to 1989. Box of Sin is available as a 5-CD collection or a 4-LP set. We'll find out about just what went into putting this collection together and so much more. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. And our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, author Lori Green reads from her book, Drag Queens and Beauty Queens, Contesting Femininity in the World's Playground.
New York Avenue, where the party began. Mortimer breathes deeply and gestures broadly with his arms at the now vacant lots and rundown buildings on the west side of New York Avenue. The Saratoga was here, he points behind us. And the Shea Perry Disco. He turns and walks toward the world-famous boardwalk and makes a right on Westminster, commonly known as Snake Alley, a winding back street that connects the New York, Kentucky, and Mount Vernon Avenues in the old neighborhood. The parking lot to the right used to be the Entertainments Club, the oldest bar on the East Coast. Louise Mack, who loved gay people, owned the building, and the bottom floor was her little speakeasy nightclub, which always catered to gay men. It was one of those places where you had to knock on the door and have a code word to get in. Mortimer continues to walk, looking around, gesturing toward two large parking lots on the opposite side of the street, where the Grand Central Hotel and Studios 5 and 6 once stood before they burned down. He laughs as he kicks an abandoned beer bottle toward the curb. Gay rooming houses and hotels once choked the streets here, and it was all gay everywhere. He turns and frowns as he rounds another corner of the ghosts of properties where it was easy to pick up young men for sex and rent boys, especially in the 1980s. We turn onto Kentucky Avenue where Snake Alley ends, now a devastated parking lot, as he describes the hotels and gay businesses that used to line the west side of the street. On the corner of Pacific and Kentucky Avenues, on the right-hand side was the coffee mill. On the left-hand side, the Atlantic City Electric Company. Across the street was Kelsey's restaurant, and what used to be a pool hall and pizza parlor, rooming houses, a little gay grocery store. He pauses and points across the street to a small house, which still has a plant in the window. This is where drag queen Sandy Beach lived. Mortimer points to a little window where he remembers losing his virginity. He shakes his head, surveying the empty space. Turning right on Pacific Avenue, we walk past an empty lot, which was once Lyle's, a gay breakfast place where everybody ended up after staying out all night partying. Two prostitutes walk by, followed by their pimp arguing about cigarettes. Turning right, back down New York Avenue, he summons the ghosts of gay clubs once again, the Saratoga, the Shay, the Rendezvous, where he used to perform in drag, and where he saw his first gay sex inside the club, right on the dance floor. On the right side stood the Chester Inn, its restaurant called the Front Porch, and there was an underground club here called Pucolani with a pool. Across the street was an Italian restaurant, Mama Mott's, where he had his first gay date. It's all gone now. Camp and the queering of Miss America. The corner of New York Avenue and the boardwalk in Atlantic City Beach side is the girl side of the street, the spot where lesbians congregate to watch the parade and cheer as the cars go by carrying the Miss America pageant contestants. On the opposite side of the boardwalk, gay men stand in front of Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum waiting for the parade to begin. This year, there is an added intrigue, since this is the first time an openly lesbian contestant, Miss Missouri Eleanor Flattery, is competing for the crown as America's ideal woman. Many spectators carry rainbow flags. Some are dressed in drag, men in full makeup, women donning T-shirts with men's chests and muscular arms painted on them. Others wear rainbow kitsch, plastic sunglasses, boas, crystal-studded crowns. Both men and women flirt with local police as they beg to stand pressed up against the parade route and promise they will behave in return. Drag queen Morgan Wells stands in a gown and a headpiece on the men's side. Beside her stands a man shirtless with pierced nipples attached to chains. Gay men congregate, sorted by age and acquaintance, under the marquee of the museum. To their right quietly sits a family with beach chairs and three small tow-headed children on their laps. Shoobies, or out-of-towners as we call them, they gawk at the spectacle before them. The convertible carrying the Miss America contestants in the Show Us Your Shoes parade pass in alphabetical order. They wear costumes whimsically representing their states, with shoes held up in the air with one leg as they lean back in their seats and wave to the crowds. Show us your shoes, is screamed from New York Avenue crowds as each contestant passes. And as they do, most of them met with cheers of encouragement, waving rainbow flags, while others receive sometimes not so flattering critiques of their tepid presentations. You on New York Avenue now, honey. You ain't in Kansas anymore, someone yells in the crowd. A baton twirling team from Kentucky approaches. The young girls dressed in rainbow colored leotards draw near, and the excitement among onlookers builds. They all respond by waving their rainbow flags and chanting, twirl, girl, twirl. Twirl, girl, twirl, as they jump up and down and continue to wave their flags. The twirlers, a little disconcerted, perform their number. Flags begin waving and people push in toward the yellow cones along the parade route. Miss Missouri Eleanor Flattery is dressed in a blue and white baseball uniform and holding up a pair of bejeweled high-top sneakers. As the convertible nears, the cheers increase. She smiles, but she is demure as she waves. Jean runs toward the car, waving her rainbow flag. And though Erin smiles and waves back, she appears a bit awkward with this group of locals looking for some acknowledgement of their shared identity. The crowd chants, show us your shoes. Show us your shoes, not your midriffs. Mimi on First stands at the top of the risers as she enters wearing a 12-foot-long purple bejeweled velvet octopus stole with arms wrapped around her torso and dragging down the steps behind her. Hair high in a platinum blonde bouffant, her lips bright red. Mimi cocks her head, turns, and drops the stole coyly, revealing a sparkling black velvet swimsuit and a gold and purple shell accessories. She struts, turns her back to the audience and winks. A finger goes to her lips as if to say, oh, my, I'm so exposed. She seems oblivious to her fatness. In fact, she shows a confidence in her superior form, her extra-large body jiggling, hands on her hips accentuating her simple frame. Mimi walks down the runway, stopping at the end. She licks her lips slowly, turns, and walks back to center stage, moving her hips slowly to the music. Mimi, I'm first. Contestant number one is announced, along with her measurements, 72, 48. 72. The crowd cheers and applauds, and she bends over slowly, paws and bottom to the audience to retrieve her stole. As Mimi is escorted away by Speedo-clad male dancers, the next contestant begins to descend. Farrah Mascara steps gracefully, one stilettoed foot after the other in a sequined red robe. As she reaches the stage, her robe falls away, revealing a red cutout sequin swimsuit, fishnet stockings, and a giant lobster clawed hands as gloves. She moves her thumbs, pinching the air, flashing an open mouth toothy smile. She shakes her head side to side, her huge hair just seconds behind her. Farrah struts from one side to the other as she makes her way down the runway, ending in a figure eight, pinching claws held high. She shimmies and jiggles her large body, putting one claw to her mouth in feigned embarrassment. Miss Farrah Mascara, contestant number two. Her favorite food is chicken nuggets. Her favorite color is the rainbow. Farrah squeals and grabs the arm of one of her escorts as the next contestant appears at the top of the risers in a gold lamé robe cinched around her waist. Tina Burner descends in sparkly white platform shoes and reveals her swimsuit, white and skirted, with a gold belt and an anchor and gold tasseled epaulets on her shoulders. Tina's ginger hair is coiffed 1950s style, and she holds a captain's nautical cap, posing, one knee bent, arms by her side, wrist flexed, head cocked to one side. She walks slowly to the top of the runway and puts one white gloved hand to her mouth as she knocks her knees together and giggles. Tina Burner, contestant number three. Her favorite perfume is fishy.
Gladday Bookshop started in Gerald Moldenhauer's backpack around 1972. Gerald figured that to build community, we needed access to our history, our culture, our literature, our porn. He started schlepping books and magazines from one queer event to another to sell. As the collection got bigger, he moved it to a hall in the commune where he lived, in an old house on Seton Street in downtown Toronto. In those days, to see the books, you needed to phone first to make an appointment to come over. Gladday finally opened a fully fledged store in the late 1970s, and that's when the more public profile started causing problems. An issue with the Canadian book business is that a lot of titles are published elsewhere and therefore need to be imported, and that means they all have to pass through Canada Customs. And Canada Customs in those days was not about to let dirty, smutty, queer literature cross the border to corrupt innocent Canadians. Gladday started having books seized and shipments blocked starting in 1977. It got worse in the 80s. Even The Joy of Gay Sex got banned as obscene. And even if books got through customs, they were still not safe. In April 82, police raided Gladday and charged employee Kevin Orr with selling obscene material. And that wouldn't be the last raid. Gladday was embroiled in court cases for years. Some American publications actually started producing special Canadian editions with pages blanked out to get them across the border. In 1983, partners Bruce Smythe and Jim Deva started a gay bookstore in Vancouver called Little Sisters. Little Sisters was soon experiencing customs seizures as well. What was infuriating was that big mainstream bookstores were now importing and selling many of the same titles without a problem. It was just small, gay-run bookstores that were being targeted. Little Sisters also fought the custom seizures through the courts. But it took years and thousands of dollars before the Supreme Court finally decided that the seizures were a violation of the Charter of Rights. That was in 2000. Customs still had the right to stop materials, but the onus was on them to prove they were obscene. Customs censorship finally began to grind to a halt. By this time, queer material was widely available, and the digital age meant that borders were being largely irrelevant anyway. But today, both Glad Day and Little Sisters continue to operate as bookstores. Glad Day is actually the oldest surviving gay bookstore in the world. So if you are in Toronto or Vancouver, be sure to check them out. They're part of the living history of our community. This is Tim McCaskill, author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Box of Sin.
Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Be cheerful.
I have to say, Mark Wood, thank you on your and your new knee for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond, especially to talk about a new box set, a new music box set called Box of Sin. So I like to start my interviews by building from the ground up. So talk to me about your involvement with this fantastic new music box set, Box of Sin. What's your involvement with this?
Well, I work as a music consultant for various UK record labels. I'm based in London, so I work for Universal Music, I work for Demon Music, which is the Box of Sin label. I work for a little indie label called Needle Mythology, who are doing some exciting stuff. I work for BMG. And my job is coming up with new ideas for catalogue artists, you know, telling stories about great artists or presenting, you know, historic recordings in new ways. I'm really attracted to, I like the idea of taking a cultural moment and kind of making something physical that sort of accompanies that moment. In this case, we're talking about gay nightlife in the 1980s. So I did the title was something I came up with when I was watching during lockdown over here. We had a fantastic Russell T Davis drama called It's a Sin. And that program was about AIDS in London and how it affected a group of young, very young men in London in the 1980s and all of the, the horrific experiences at the hands of the medical profession and politicians and the media and society at large, you know, the sort of plague narrative. And it was very, very good, very, very moving. You know, it's well worth a watch if you guys get it there. But one thing that did slightly not kind of ring completely true was the fact that the music in it didn't sound like what I remembered hearing in clubs in the 80s. So I think, you know, there was some artistic license there. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if you could celebrate? Because I sort of came of age in the mid-1980s. I went to my first gay venue in Camden Town in London in 1984. So I was there for most of it, you know, going to pubs and clubs and hearing music around. And, you know, and it was actually a lot more diverse than people thought. And I wanted to reflect that musical diversity in London anyway. You had your sort of gay super clubs like Heaven, which are, you know, fantastic, sophisticated sound systems, that very kind of forward-thinking electronic music. There was a massive, thriving alternative gay scene as well, which was much more your edgy electro pop, your Soft Cell and Depeche Mode. There was a lot of out and out, you know, massive chart pop. I mean, the charts were so gay for such a homophobic time. The charts were probably more gay than they've ever been before or since in the 1980s. So I wanted to reflect that. And then, you know, the divas who were always with us in our nightlife, you know, your Donna Summers, Aretha Franklin. So I wanted to sort of tip the hat to the fact that, you know, we heard a lot of divas in the 80s, as we do now. And then towards the end of the 80s, when I was properly on the scene, house music. It's where house music came through from Chicago and was instantly sort of taken up by the gay clubs here first. And that really set the tone for the 90s in British clubbing, where you just didn't hear anything except house. I mean, that was the start of something. So you start at the beginning of the decade with a sound that's very much related to disco. You go through the middle of the decade when it gets kind of much more electronic and disco turns into a much kind of more programmed and electronic sound. And then at the end, you've got house music. And that's what I was trying to achieve with Box of Sin, to kind of make it the perfect accompaniment to this great TV show I'd seen. And also, you know, what I would say about Box of Sin that really excited me about this music that was heard at gay clubs. We called them gay clubs then. We call them different things now, queer clubs or LGBTQ spaces, whatever. But in those days, gay clubs, I'm using this term because that's what they were then. It didn't matter where a record came from. So on the collection, you've got stuff coming at you from Italy, loads of stuff from the US, obviously. You've got these kind of little amateurish electronic duos suddenly having massive, massive hits in gay clubs, you know, from the north of England. You've got South African artists. You know, it really was such a mixed bag. People recording in France, you know, that have emigrated to France from America, and all of these beautiful sounds made for a truly international experience. So while I was thinking about my London clubbing experiences, this stuff was happening in New York. It was happening in Berlin. It was happening in Sydney. It was happening the whole world over. And some of it was happening in the mainstream heterosexual pop charts, if only they knew it. They just didn't always know that.
So we have 12-inch mixes, I believe 54 tracks on CD and vinyl. You've got artists like you just mentioned, Donna Summer, Whitney Houston, Aretha Franklin, Dead or Alive, Bronski Beat. You've got Bananarama, Boy George, and many, many more. So talk to me about the process of curating these tracks that would make up this 5 CD set. And I believe on the vinyl, it's 24 tracks in total. Talk to me about the process of curating this, because my understanding is you also used club charts from that time frame to help you. So talk to me about the curation process.
Sure. So it started with me, you know, sketching out these 4 or 5 different areas that I thought we could theme, you know, divas, high energy, house, etc. And so sort of started off with those, and I just got a spreadsheet going, Mark, and just started dumping track titles in the spreadsheet as I remembered enjoying them, you know, in my own club nights. And then I looked at the actual Club Charts. We had a great magazine here in the 80s called Record Mirror, and Gay Times also published queer clubbing charts. So there were two places you could look at. They were called the Boys Town Charts, you know, in the early 80s. But and then they were called the Gay Charts and stuff. So I sort of like went through those as a sort of sense check to see if my memory was serving me well. And in some cases it was, and in others, you know, I unearthed things which I'd completely forgotten about how big they were on the dance floors of heaven or wherever. So it was sort of fairly robust, and I had a, you know, I've got a great circle of friends and people that I've met in nightclubs over the years who were there as well. And, you know, I used them as a springboard, you know, and, you know, they would say, yeah, don't forget XYZ. Don't forget Passion by the Flirts. Don't forget this. And we ended up with a very, very long list of about 150 songs eventually. So, and then that's the dream, you know, to put out a 15 CD box set or whatever, but they've never let us do that, which is why the vinyl is half the size of tracks, because it's just would make it so expensive, it'd be prohibitive. So and then you go into a process called licensing, Mark, and that's when you find out whether the rights owners will let you use the music, and some of them,
when the rubber meets the road.
That's right, reality bites. And that's when you find out that, you know, so-and-so, Pet Shop Boys, for example, weren't clearing at the time we were doing this box. They were working on their own recent greatest hits, so they just temporarily said, can't help you out, mate. So we got Liza Minnelli and we got Dusty Springfield on there instead, who were both Pet Shop Boys productions. And, you know, were we to do a volume two, which, you know, I'd love to do, hopefully we'd go back and the Pet Shop Boys would be open. And then you've got many, many labels, little European labels that own so much of the gorgeous Eurobeat stuff that I wanted. We just couldn't find the rights holders. And, you know, you don't want someone coming after you. So that was sort of, you know, there were a few things that we just ran out of time. We ran out of road. We had to close the licensing process, and then you know what you're working with. You've got your 54 tracks or whatever. Then it's just the nice part is sequencing them, you know, putting them in order and getting sleeve notes together. We did spend nearly a year on the concept and the checking and the sleeve notes research, because sleeve notes are quite extensive in Box of Sin.
We just mentioned the sleeve notes. It features an introduction by renowned gay author Paul Burstyn. And you just mentioned it took, what, over a year, the process to put this all together?
Yes, probably, yes. And you know, I have
that to That sounds talk quick.
Yeah, I mean, it's never as quick as your record label would like. They'd like everything out next week. But Paul came on. Paul's been a friend of mine since the mid-90s. I helped establish a club in London called Ducky, which is still going. And we were more of an sort of an alternative kind of cabaret, very punk kind of thing. And in the 90s, I was DJing there, and I met Paul Burstyn, who at the time was the working for Time Out, which was, you know, our big listings magazine in London. And Paul's always been very supportive. He's sort of had the same clubbing journey that I did, and I thought he writes so beautifully about, you know, coming out, going onto the scene for the first time, being young and gay from Wales in the big city. And he just completely knocked it out of the park. He wrote a beautiful introduction for us. And I think it sort of resonates with a lot of our experiences when you move to, you know, an unfamiliar place, and you've got that kind of frisson of excitement about finally you're going to be yourself, but also it's scary.
Okay, so you've got some great music. You've got pretty much wall-to-wall dance music. You've got some great artists. But it all ends with, and I'm telling you, I'm not going from, of course, the musical and the movie, a great song. I think I know the answer to this question, but talk to me about ending on a ballad with this box set.
Yeah, sure. So two things going on there, really. Obviously, it's three things, maybe. One, it's the... I went to so many clubs and parties and house parties and one-off nights, and it still happens to this day. And at the end, when the lights went on, that would often be the song that they would play to stop dancing and to get you out of the toilets. And, you know, that would be one. So
the ugly lights come on.
Exactly. So it was a very, very effective and also, you know, cathartic and amazing way to end a brilliant night out in the city. Secondly, a lot more seriously, it soundtracked an awful lot of funerals for people who died of AIDS. It was a beautiful, you know, and poignant song that was heard at a lot of services. The other one being Don't Leave Me This Way, which is also on the set as in the version by the Communards. Thirdly, it was just because, I don't know, I think I can probably count in the hundreds the number of drag queens I've seen lip syncing to Telling You I'm Not Going. You know, it feels like while it's not a dance track and the album is, the box set is ostensibly about the dance floor, it felt like such a important part of the decade, and to this day, you know, that sort of song, that sort of defiance. Because if Box of Sin is about anything, it's about dancing with defiance in the face of some pretty shitty stuff, you know, going on out there, which the 80s was very, very painful for lots of people, especially for gay people. It was hard and you had to make your own fun. And what came out of it was this incredibly joyous music and this culture that pretty much invented how we're still clubbing today.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
So, I wanted to take this time to let you know about the next evolution of Rainbow Country, simply called Rainbow Country Plus. Streaming 24/7 on YouTube. It's currently live, and to check it out, simply head over to marktara.ca, where, of course, everything is connected, and hit the poster. It's right there, it's simple, and of course, it's free. And currently features interviews from filmmakers that have been part of the Toronto International Film Festival that I've had the honor of interviewing. So I hope you'll take a little time and check it out. Rainbow Country Plus, the next evolution of this little gay radio show.
Hi, My name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer. And I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And of course our artists and the things that we do globally and to talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Mark Wood, you are a music consultant, you're a songwriter, you're a musician, you are a DJ. So here's a question. Who are the reader's wives?
They are, the reader's wives was, you know, it's not a name I would particularly, when Ducky was starting at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, for those of you who don't know, is a very historic queer venue in South London, right on the River Thames, and it's been there since the Georgian times, you know, Regency London. And it's a big round tavern with a stage, and it has pretty much been at the forefront of queer London since at least the First World War, you know, 100 years. So by the time we rock up to the 90s, you know, there was a bunch of us who kept running into one another. And we had this 4-week offer from the Vauxhall Tavern, which was not on its last legs, but it had seen better days. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was quiet and they didn't really have much going on their Saturday night. So they gave it, you know, we were just stupid kids. You know, they said, you can have it for a month. And Simon Strange, who still runs Ducky, just said, do you want to DJ for 4 weeks? And so I said, I don't want to do it on my own. I'll do it with my best friend. And I don't know why we said it. We said we'd do it in drag. You know, we'd never done drag. But it was just 4 weeks, Mark. You know, we weren't really thinking, and we had to have a name. And in British seedy porn magazines at the time, there was always a reader's wife section where people would send in photos of themselves with no clothes on. You know, women would send in pictures of themselves. It really wasn't something that we thought that much about. We just had to have a name. And then what happened after that was Ducky just became phenomenally successful. By week three, we had queues going around the block. You know, you couldn't get in. We were more surprised than anybody because we hadn't taken it that seriously. And, you know, we had such low expectations of that night that we were terrified that it would look empty. So we'd filled the dance floor with old 1970s sofas and standard lamps and chairs and armchairs. And, you know, with all these people suddenly start turning up, you know, we'd be like pushing the furniture out the door to make more room so people could actually come in. Mm. And I guess it was just me and my best friend mucking about.
Mark Johnston?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Otherwise known as Jelly. And he's still my best friend and still my DJ partner. And we felt like, okay, well, let's do it for, they said, do you want to do January? And then January was extended to the following Easter. And then, you know, 4 weeks turned into 30 years almost, you know, 28 years we're on now this month. So.
But you guys were a duo.
We were a DJ duo, yeah, that's right, because I just didn't want to do it on my own. I mean, you know, you've got London. London was amazing in the 90s because it felt very, it was, you know, so much more optimistic and light than the 80s had been. You know, there was a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, there was the whole, London suddenly felt very, very cool again for a few years. And there was a brilliant spirit of do it yourself, you know, just set up your own club, set up your, you know, just be a DJ, do. And I think we were kind of, we caught that wave and we used it as an opportunity to just play all the things loud that we wanted to hear loud. You know, some of the stuff we played, I don't think anyone had ever played in clubs before. Like we played Kate Bush and, you know, stuff like really mad, mad records. And thinking that we would only be the only people that would be enjoying it. And that's led to a long time. So I never wanted to be a full-time DJ. It was always something really nice to do with my best friend at the weekend. And it still is. So Ducky is going strong, still putting on very left of center performance, and we're still playing the music that we like. So yeah, that's where the Reader's Wives came from. But if we were to do it again, I think we'd probably think a lot clearer about what we wanted to be called for 30 years.
So, okay. So then 2016 comes around and you guys release Gaslight.
Yeah, I think Gaslight came out before that, actually. But I can't take too much credit for the music side. I wrote the lyrics for that album, but we had some regulars from the club called Jez and Mark, who had a lot of synths and a lot of computers and were very clever. And they said, please can we make some music? And you know, Mark Jelly is a really good singer. I've got no singing voice, so I sort of, you know, chipped in with some ideas for how I thought records should feel, and I wrote the lyrics. And yeah, we had some fun doing, you know, we had some fun doing that one. We keep saying we must do another one, but life gets in the way. It's like, you know,
yeah, like box us in.
Box of Sin and all the other things I'm doing. I'm working with Soft Cell at the moment, and that's been consuming me.
What are you doing with Soft Cell?
We've announced a very big fan of Soft Cell, and I do work with Mark a lot. But we've announced a big box set of Non-Stop Erotic Cabaret, which was the debut album, which is Tainted Love album. And it's sort of everything. And there's new stuff on there, and there's unreleased stuff, and there's the original album. And we've just mixed it at Abbey Road Studios in Atmos, Dolby Atmos. So that was just the first time I've ever sort of tried doing something like that, working with engineers and making old audio into something that's completely immersive. And we're having today's job is inviting people to a very small and select playback in Soho Square in next Thursday to hear it in the Dolby cinema there. So, you know, it's like no two projects are the same. I've been working with Girls Aloud this year. I look after the catalogue for Roxy Music. You know, there's always something going on, and you know, hopefully another box of Sin. I really do like telling these stories. I really think I'd like to sort of talk about the amazing design of the box, which I think really sells it. It's just so beautiful looking, and I can't take any credit for that. I found a young agency in East London called Oink, who I just sent them three pictures, three black and white pictures from Getty of gay men in heaven in the early 80s. And I said, I just need it to feel like this.
Is the cover, is it Tom of Finland?
No, it's actually a composite of several pictures, photography, that this terrific young artist called John Conlon, who works for Oink, you know, he wasn't born when these records were out, but he just got it. You know, he just got the whole concept, and he found several pictures. I think the moustache on that picture is painted on, or maybe the ball gag on the version inside, maybe that's the bit that's painted on. But, you know, he was very clever with it, and very clever with the colour and all of the little kind of visual riffs. What I did with John is I wanted it to look like the 80s. I didn't want it to look like something from the 2020s. So I took him to the Queer Institute in Bishopsgate in Liverpool Street in London, where they have an amazing British queer archive. And you can just go in and it's a library. And they were very, very helpful. And they gave us boxes and boxes of Gay Times. And I said, make the sleeve notes look like the Gay Times small ads from the 80s. So that's why it looks like it does. And the Bishopsgate Institute also provided, you know, photography and guidance, and they, you know, and you know, it was one of those projects where everybody is really good at it, you know. So we had great help from Bishopsgate. We had great design people on board. We had a very supportive record label, and it all came together into something that was, you know, sort of quite satisfying.
How did you settle on the cover for the set, the profile, like of all things, the profile? Because it does remind me of Tom of Finland, like those.
Well, we love Tom, yeah, exactly. Well, that's kind of the point. Well, I mean, that was sort of the point, really, Mark, because looking through the Gay Times,
very, you know, leather, denim, you know,
there was lots of that going on. You know,
handkerchiefs, the different colors and what they meant.
Absolutely. So it was hankies and leathers and chaps and check shirts and a lot of moustaches. And, you know, it was, if you're going through those Gay Times, there were sort of two or three main looks for gay men, and they would be the leather look. There was a sort of alternative, more androgynous look, you know, bit of makeup, a lot of eyeliner, very Depeche Mode, you know, that kind of thing. Or a bit later, you start getting something which is a bit more clean cut and gym focused, you know, shaved heads and topless and, you know, really good gym bodies and little shorts and everything. So, you know, he picked up on the leather look as being sort of like pretty representative of what we were trying to reflect, especially for the early years of the music in the box set. You know, that was the look. And, you know, again, 17, 18 years old, it was quite terrifying, you know, skinny and going to places, and you've got all these kind of beefy men with moustaches wearing leather. It was heady.
Would you agree with the following statement that I'm about to make? And the statement is simply this: the influence of 80s gay nightlife has had an influence on electronic music, on pop music, on the evolution of clubbing. Would you agree with that statement? Is that a fair statement to make?
100%, because I think 100%. I think that lots of the things which happened in gay clubs first, and you can pick one out of the air. So, you know, electronic music,
Madonna. Do you think Madonna would be here without the support of the gay community?
No, I know, and I think she would be the first to admit it. You know, like whenever straight audiences do not seem to be as loyal to their artists. You know, maybe some of them are, but the Beatles fans or whatever. But you know, I wanted to do the Divas disc for Box of Sin because I do think there is something about that relationship between these kind of very powerful singers and that crowd. And, you know, the late nights, the lighting, the strobes, even the drugs, you know, I think that straight people started behaving like gay people in nightclubs towards the end of the decade when house came in, and we had over here, we had this huge explosion of house. And that's when the barriers really broke down between gay clubs for a while, you know, between queer spaces and straight places, because everybody was just digging the same stuff. And it, for a while, it was very, very mixed and polysexual, to use a sort of word that we used to use in the 90s.
Hmm. Who do you think is the audience for Box of Sin?
I always think it's not a good idea to think too much about who they are. What I do is I think, okay, so what would I buy? That's where I start with these things. You know, I'm first and foremost a music fan, and I see a lot of, you know, I see a lot of endlessly recycled albums with the same music on. They all kind of look the same, and I just sort of think, well, what, how do we kind of make this feel a bit more cared for, you know, and you know, elevated? You know, it's why we went to Bishopsgate, it's why we found a designer, you know, it's why we didn't just slap, you know, like a random library picture on the front and just get on with it. I think if you know that I'm what I would buy if I couldn't make it, and I know that I probably know enough people who I suspect would probably make it too, I'm always suspicious. I think the music industry, like a lot of industries, is run far too much on market research and demographics. And I think it takes a lot of the romance out. Maybe I'm just an old romantic, but I think it takes a lot of the fun and the romance out of it. And it was all done on feel, really, thinking, I just know this. It's like when you're a DJ and you hear something new and you think, that's never going to work, or that's really going to work on a dance floor, and it will work on the dance floor at one-ish in the morning. It's a feel thing, you know, and it's like, I sort of go by that, really. I mean, and hope that, you know, what I'm encouraged by is that a lot of the younger people who, you know, they know a bit of 80s, they know a bit about their culture. I've seen some very sweet things about that. From that sort of generation below mine. You know, I'm a Gen Xer. If millennials and Gen Z get it too, then that's absolutely fine by me.
So Mark Wood, here's my last question for you. And it's simply this. You were talking earlier about, you know, telling stories through this box set. So what do you hope listeners come away with, other than having a good time and dancing to this amazing music? What do you hope, over and above that audiences come away with after they've heard Box of Sin?
I hope that people... what the sort of philosophy, if you like, behind it, apart from wanting people to listen to some amazing records, I hope that people realize that, you know, when times are really dark, and I don't want to trivialize anything for anybody, but the 80s was particularly shitty for gay people, gay men and lesbians and bisexuals and, you know, and queer people and trans people, pretty fucking bad. I think that out of all of that, what was built was a really kind of vibrant and thriving creativity, community, sense of togetherness. Dancing in a nightclub is all about togetherness and people coming together in defiance of the shitty time that they're having. And, you know, that is what I hope, is that, you know, you can still love and laugh and dance in the face of adversity, I think. And, you know, that's what I sort of, that's what kept striking me as I was listening and remembering the people that were lost to AIDS, especially, and the number of funerals that you'd hear about, and, you know, all of the great artists that we lost through AIDS. And just thinking, but even so, people didn't give up. People kept on making music, enjoying music. People kept on dancing with each other, loving each other, whatever.
Mark Wood, well said. Well said, well done, well made, well curated. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really had to think about some of those answers because you made me articulate quite a lot of what was going on in my head. Thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be asked.
Box of Sin is available as a 5-CD collection or a 4-album set, and is available wherever you get your favorite music. But wait, there's more. More Sin. Box of Sin 2 is out now and available wherever you get your favorite music. A 5-CD set or 4-LP collection.
Bill 7. To ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive Conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. 4 PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, Gay Pirates, from Canadian gay artist Evan Westfall.
Once upon a nautical time, a man sailed into my lips. Now let me tell you, boys, I've spent time living on broken ships. I'll set a course throughout the sea. I wouldn't have it any other way. I'll anchor down my pirate ship when I find a man to steal away. Now pirate love, it's kind of gay, with all that talk of booty and such. But what I mean to say is there is this guy, I think that I could love him very much. I'll set a course throughout the sea, I wouldn't have it any other way. I found a man to steal away. Love is cliche. I'm sailing through a raging sea of hormones. This disarray of thought will lead me straight to where I mean to feel your chest. Treasure chest wherein lies my secrets. They're for you to see. Be a part of me.
Hi, this is Police Constable Danielle Botno, also known as LGBT Cop, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Mm.
This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think I'm bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off, A Box of Sin, three song set.